Globalism has woven sticky strands across the earth. Our current world is a frenzied global web, made so through the movement of monies, resources, goods, and people. Parallel to the rapid communication of the internet or the possibility of travel between hemispheres in a single day, neo-globalism is defined by unprecedented speed of movement across long distance. Also definitive of the neo-global era is the non-mutuality of relationship. A few benefit at the cost of many. It is precisely these systems that can make living in the U.S. so comfortable. The United States' reliance upon political and economic coercion to gain global access to natural resources and cheap labor has helped to create the material abundance that is available to people like you and me. These current systems come at great cost to the larger human community as well as to the health of our planet. Disturbingly, these costs are intentionally masked. The human work and natural resources that create a shirt become invisible in the process of it reaching a store shelf. Such realities pose serious questions to those of us who dream of a more just world. Not only out of concern for the well-being of others and the earth, but also as reflected in the truth spoken by Martin Luther King Jr. when he said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. In light of our ever-increasing interconnectedness, it is vital that we discuss in community how we want to be together as co-weavers of our mutual destiny. It is important to recognize that these systems and relationships have been broken intentionally. What so intimately and profoundly shapes lives has been intentionally broken with racism, segregation, greed, materialism, and fear. The presence of such brokenness serves to prevent connection and compassion. It keeps the system's parts divided, less powerful. Meanwhile, the systemic whole appears as unchangeable. This is the social soup within which we are simmering. These reflections bring up painful and challenging questions. I wonder, how am I a mirror of these systems? What brokenness have I internalized along the way? What does it mean to truly challenge my own privilege? And is it possible to use this privilege to create change without perpetuating the same hierarchy and imbalance of power, which I hope to help dismantle? Reflecting on questions of social change, I find both inspiration and caution within the parable of the compassionate Samaritan from the Gospel of Luke. Jesus is reported to have shared this parable in response to a lawyer who asked the question, "Teacher, who is my neighbor?" Jesus, responding with a story, described a man who was accosted while journeying between lands. The robbers who violently attack the traveler leave him half dead in a ditch, stripped, beaten, and vulnerable. A priest who happened to walk by sees the man, and rather than respond, walks to the other side of the road. Likewise, a Levite passes the man in the ditch and also chooses not to acknowledge his suffering. But a Samaritan, a member of a rejected ethnic minority group, was also traveling that dusty road in the borderlands. He saw the man experiencing agony and was moved to compassion. The Samaritan came to the man, bandaged his wounds, put him on his own animal, and brought him to an inn where he cared for him, giving of both his time and money out of compassion for this stranger who he chose instead to treat as neighbor and friend. I find this story most challenging when I imagine myself as the different characters. How have I responded to the agony of others? What were the times in which I have been the wounded? When aware of another's pain, have I stayed safe and disengaged by quickly walking to the other side of the road? Or do I choose instead to be like the Samaritan and respond to suffering by bravely entering into relationship with the unknown? How may I make myself more vulnerable by responding to the vulnerability of another? How might I make myself open to being changed by relationship? This is a story that speaks to our Unitarian Universalist religious imperative to act justly in our relationships, to connect through love, and to honor the worth and dignity that we affirm is universally endowed. It is a story that is often referred to by liberal prophetic voices, speaking on the need for more compassion to be expressed in our immigration policies. Unfortunately, while I find the parable is useful in exploring the question of who is my neighbor, I can find it difficult to apply this parable directly. While I have learned about some of the traumas and stresses that face undocumented families, because of my privilege, I do not generally encounter these pains on the side of the road. I do not walk by the detention center on my way anywhere. I do not live in fear that someone I know and love will be deported. Segregation and fear make relationships between undocumented immigrants and the native-born rare. In order to respond like the compassionate Samaritan, it is going to take imagination, vision, and courage. Whether you choose to respond by working toward policy change or by accompanying local families, the commitment to offering love rather than fear will require us to leave our individual worlds and go into discomfort. May we do this work with an ethic of accompaniment from a place of right relationship and connection, thereby allowing empowering space for immigrants to speak their own stories and define their own needs. When we enter into these dusty roads of vulnerability, may we dare connection instead of convenience. And may we be transformed through the experience of being with others in the spirit of love and the fire of commitment.
We invite you to stay seated, but sing the second verse of the call of love.
It's this path we walk, oh, freely hand in hand. It's this path that protects us when we feel we don't stand a chance. It's this path that's laid out from me to you and them.
To share with you the experience of what happens to families in our mixed-up immigration system, the way in which we disconnect individuals from their origins. and his book, Care of the Soul, Thomas More defines family saying, "We all know family in its particulars. It has, this is the nest in which soul is born, nurtured, and released into life. It has an elaborate history and ancestry. Its stories tell of happy times and tragedies. Family, the first place in which we might experience community, may be imperfect and vulnerable, and yet it may hold so many possibilities for growth and support, for building our capacities and finding our gifts. This is how the faith community sees family. And as a community, we must strive to support families to be the best that they can be, to offer children what they need, and to be a place of development and strength. For immigrant families in the United States, this relationship is even more tenuous and fraught with danger. I worked for 13 years in the community college systems in Texas and here in Colorado, and I watched many families being torn apart by our very convoluted system. And I often experienced a sense of brokenheartedness. This year, as the state of Colorado and our national leaders struggle to pave a path to citizenship for young people, allowing them to attend college affordably and find jobs, as well as developing comprehensive reform to help whole families, allowing them to stay together and to work together, I hope that we can keep families whole and embrace their gifts and talents, hard work and initiative that they arrive with and grow into. I'm going to share a couple of stories about a couple of families. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Do you remember?
Do you remember the stories of your parents? Egypt is the land, the time, the situation where you were persecuted and misunderstood. Egypt is intolerance and slavery. Egypt is a place where you felt alone. Egypt is a feeling of lashes on your back and curses on your soul.
I had a student named Muriel. Her mom brought her to Colorado when she was 3. She has a sister who was born here. Her mom is single and works as a maid. Muriel was an honors high school student. She got straight A's and she was completely no-nonsense. She worked hard in class and she was a perfectionist. She wants to be a doctor. She's had childhood diabetes and she's struggled with her health, but you'd never know it. Here in Colorado, she can't even get in-state tuition. Her sister qualifies for food stamps, but she doesn't. This is just the beginning. Muriel doesn't even speak much Spanish. She wants to stay in college, but she can't afford it, and she can't receive the scholarship she won from the mayor of Denver because she's not legal. Thousands of students graduate every year from our local high schools, smart kids, kids who want to go to college and make a difference, kids whose parents tried to come here legally, and kids whose parents didn't. Kids whose parents understood the laws they were breaking, but mostly kids whose parents wanted for them what I want for my daughters: safety, food, housing, an opportunity to thrive, jobs, bread. I don't know what I was supposed to say to the kids that I worked with. What are we supposed to tell them? Who's going to invite them to the dinner made from our harvest? What can we plan to offer them?
Love them as yourself. Love them as yourself. We're all one. There's a unity that makes us one. All souls are sacred and worthy. Love, love, love is a verb. This is what you do and what you say and how you do it and how you say it. These are the laws you make and the cities you build and the taxes you collect and the ethics you teach, the values you live by.
Last night when I was putting my youngest to bed, the 3-year-old, I imagined that I was Muriel's mom. I imagined Muriel as a tiny girl in a dusty Mexican village where there is no work and no men. They're all working somewhere else. There's no food bank, no hospital, no one with more money to help. I imagine her mama looking at her beautiful hija the way I look at mine and deciding to find a way to cross the border, a way into Los Estados Unidos. And I imagine them here with a new fear. It's no longer the fear of not being able to feed, clothe, and house this beautiful girl. It is the fear of being caught, separated, of losing her. I wonder what Muriel dreams about at night, what she thinks about her future. Does she see one? How does she keep hope alive?
He can live with you. They already live with you. They have always lived with you. They are you. They can live. They do. They can. You can. We will. Si se puede.
Si se puede. I invite you into my heartbreak. I ask you to share it with me. I ask you to care enough to ask what we can do, and there are no easy answers. I can't tell you what will fix this, but I can tell you what won't. Ignoring these children and their families, locking them up or trying to send them home won't help. I ask you to love them first, and then I ask you to find out how we can work together to make their dreams ours and our dreams theirs. I ask you first to simply join me in prayer for these families and their children. I ask you to keep them in your prayers and to ask how we can share this harvest, how we can love without heartbreak, how we can reap the harvest. There is an abundance. There is enough. We all reap the harvest, and the harvest is not just yours. The harvest is a gift from the earth to all of us. Therefore, reap the harvest, but do not withhold the harvest. And we will sing the last verse of our song with Jen.
We walk in the ways of love, even when we feel we don't have enough love to give. Just reach out and there's a hand to hold us when we cannot hold ourselves. There's a shoulder to lean on when we cannot find our ground. There's a heart just waiting to take up the loving call. It's the cannot hold ourselves. There's a shoulder to lean on when we cannot find our ground. There's a heart just waiting to take up the loving call.